Just one note, two notes of Inyana Dioma of interest. Firstly, what is it exactly that we're commemorating today when we're fasting? So most of you probably assume, not incorrectly, that Asara B'Teves is a commemoration of the siege of Yerushalayim when it began by Nebuchadnezzar. And that's on Asara B'Teves. There is, however, a machlokus about what the fast, when the fast is supposed to be and what it's for. And number two, even in the construct that we work with, that Asara B'Teves is in fact the day that Nebuchadnezzar was Someh, and there are actually two other things that are connected to the fast, which are actually found in the first Slicha. I don't know if Sfaradim recite the exact same Slicha that the Ashkenazim do, but in the Ashkenazi Slicha, there are three events that are referred to that this fast is supposed to commemorate. Number one is Asara B'Teves. It's not in order, but okay. Number two is the death of Ezra HaSofer. I believe that's on the 8th of Teves. And number three, on the 9th of Teves, was the translation of the Septuagint. Which seems a little strange, because those of you who learn the Gemara Megillah know that it seems to be a miraculous translation. However, when you look in Maseches Sofer in the first parak, there seems to be the tradition of Megillah is in one Mishnah, but immediately preceding that is a different Mishnah that says that they translated for Ptolemy, and v'haya oso ayom kasha liYisrael kiyom shenasa bo ha'egel she'ena Torah yachol litargim kol tzarka. That day was as hard for the Jewish people as bad as the day that the Egel was made, because you can't translate the Torah properly. What this means is that whenever one studies Torah, it really ideally cannot be done in translation. As soon as you translate it, you lose the original. And that would be true in general. There are a lot of people who like to quote things quoting things, but in reality you're supposed to see it yourself. You don't trust when Tosfos quotes Rashi. You check Rashi yourself. And in the same sense, you know, it's sort of a little bit the way Rav Shechter likes to say that they know the Ktosis from Rav Chaim's, and they know the Rashba from the Ktos, and they know the Gemara from the Rashba, and they know the Pasuk from the Gemara. And it's supposed to work the other way. You're supposed to really engage things and encounter things in the original. So it's Ahoy Oseim Kashakim Shinasaba Eagle. That's one point that's one piece of it that we have in our Slicha. Three different things commemorate today's fast. There is, however, another issue which comes up in the Gemara Rosh Hashanah, I believe it's Daf Yud Ches Amud Beis, where this is one of the four things that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says that my Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva, darshins one way, and I'm not the Resh Kamoso. It's a Tosefta in Sota, but this particular passage is a passage in Zechariah, when Zechariah was asked what I think might be the first Shaila recorded in Jewish history, unless the Shaila in Haggai was earlier. That Haggai wasn't a Shaila, Haggai was a Bechina, but this is probably the first Shaila in Jewish history. So these people asked Zechariah Hanavi whether or not they should continue fasting Tzom Harvi, Tzom HaChamishi, Tzom HaShvi, Tzom HaAsiri. And he answered whatever he answered. And the Gemara explains that Tzom Harvi is Shivasar B'Tammuz, and Tzom HaChamishi, although the first Beis HaMikdash was the ninth of Tammuz, according to Bavli, Tzom HaChamishi is Tisha B'Av, Tzom HaShvi is Tzom Kedaya, and Tzom HaAsiri was the machlokus between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon Yochai. Rabbi Akiva said that Tzom HaAsiri was the fifth day of Teves, because the fifth day of Teves was when the news of the destruction reached the diaspora. It's recorded in Yechezkel. That's one day. When they were told Hukisah Ha'ir, that the city had been destroyed. But Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says that no, that the real that Tzom HaAsiri is supposed to be Asara B'Teves, the day. I'm sorry, I have it. I may have it the reverse, but I think it's the reverse. Rabbi Akiva says that it is Asara B'Teves. Rabbi Shimon Yochai says no, it's really Chamisha B'Teves. And Rabbi Shimon says that my position makes more sense because the events, the fasts, are actually in the order that they occurred. Right? If Tzom HaChamishi is when the news, Tzom HaAsiri is when the news reached the exile, so that was after the Korban, so it is therefore conceivable, but not conceivable, likely, that Tzom Harvi is when they broke through the walls of Yerushalayim. Tzom HaChamishi is when they set the Beis HaMikdash on fire, destroy the Mikdash, whatever it is. Tzom HaShvi is a couple months later when Gedaliah is assassinated. And Tzom HaAsiri is when the news of the destruction finally reaches the diaspora. And we're supposed to Rabbi Akiva's opinion, which is the one that we actually do hold of, is that the fasts are out of order. Asar B'Teves, historically speaking, commemorates an event that comes first, and then Shavas Tamuz, then Tisha B'Av, and then Tzom Gedaliah. So anyway, so we have the fast on the 10th of Teves, like Rabbi Akiva, not on the 5th of Teves, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. One last suggestion I would make, which is very kedai too, that I think people should do. I don't know that the minhag, it's recorded in minhag anywhere, but I think it would be appropriate, is that since you're fasting today, so one of the things that goes with the fast is tzedakah. So I would, if I may be so bold as to suggest that the money that you would have spent on food, assuming that you're not bound to a calf card, that may like more difficult, but if you would have spent cash on food, so the meals that you're going to skip today, you know, you should try to give that to tzedakah. Okay. We resume with the Gemara in Bavli Tzia, still in Dina de Bar Metzor, and we get to the discussion of Mashkanta. So, what is a Mashkanta? An interesting linguistic question, which the Gemara might answer, but I suspect it's a folk etymology that I don't know. What is the origin, the etymology of Mashkanta? I don't know the answer to that question. It's not a biblical Hebrew word. You know, you really have two possibilities that you could surmise from the root. One is the way the Gemara takes it here. How does the Gemara take it here? As something with the Shin Chaf Nun, something about dwelling. So it's almost as if the object dwells on the Rishus of the Malveh, which is definitely possible. You do have mem that are performatives, but I don't know. I can't think of any offhand that fit the pattern of Mashkan. And the alternative is to see the own as an ending, as a suffix, and see it as something to do with Mashach, something you make Mashiach on. I don't know. I know that it's hard to tell because this verb, assuming this is a three-letter root in the first place, this word becomes a four-letter root. Because how do you say to take a mashkan from someone? The mashkan. And when you say ein mim mashkan and al tzedaka, even if the mem were a prefix, it's now has become part of the root. This is not unusual. There's a very famous Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayos in the first parak of Trumas where he points out that the root in biblical Hebrew to separate Truma, the word is herim and the root is reish vav mem. And nonetheless, Mishnah Hebrew, Rabbinic Hebrew is different than Biblical Hebrew. And what happened in Biblical Hebrew, how do you say he took Truma? Taram, the Taf of Truma, which is really a prefix, like Truma, Tekuma, Taluna, Tenuva, etc., Tevua, that Taf became part of a root, and now you have a verb in Rabbinic Hebrew, Taf Reishman, Taram, Lo Yitrom, and so on. Okay. So the Gemara, in this context, the etymology matters for the Gemara, because the Gemara is going to use that to interpret things. So you have a Mashkon, which means that Yoni loaned Gabe money, and in order to make sure that Gabe paid him back, Yoni has a mashkon on a particular piece of land that belongs to Gabe. Now, who does that land belong to, fundamentally? Okay, how do you know that? Maybe it's too obvious, but you're not yet, Ephraim? What's that? Well, we could discuss that question, but there's a more, again, maybe the answer is so obvious that it's not fair to ask the question, is that Gabe can be Masalik Yoni with money. If he pays him back the loan, he holds on to the field. So we wouldn't say that he's paying back, that he's buying the field back from Yoni. We would say that he's being Masalik, Masalik Yoni from it, which is why, not for our sugya, but when you get a field of the mashkon, there is something that becomes very, very complicated, which is who eats the payros produced by the field. This is a whole discussion in Ezehu Neshach, because if Yoni were to eat the payros of the field, and ultimately Gabe were to pay back the loan, then Yoni would have taken interest because he gave Gabe ma'os, and bischar those ma'os, Yoni ate the peiros and he gets his malus back in the end. So that's why that's a very big deal, what you do with peiros. But we don't have to pay attention to the peiros. You should just be aware that's a question. So the Gemara says that when there's an ashkon, les be mishum dina de bar mitzvah. So this is a little complicated. What does it mean, les be mishum dina de bar mitzvah? There are multiple options here, some of which or all of which could be true. What do we envision happens here? There are two possibilities, I think, that emerge initially. Two things that could happen. Fine. Oh, so I think that's a fair way of putting it, right? There's another way of doing this, but let's say one possibility is, but you really jumped a step. You have to talk about, did he pay back the loan? Did he not pay back the loan? So let's assume that he did, let's assume right now that he doesn't pay back the loan. Well, let's assume he doesn't pay back the loan. So Yoni is going to take this field as payment for the non-payment of the loan. Now, in a sense, it's as if Gabe has done what? What is another way of reframing this entire story? Correct. Gabe sold the field to Yoni. Yoni bought, Yoni's the lokeach and Gabe is the mocher. Now, I'm not picking on that point some. There's a reason for it. It's a comment that I think the Ramban makes about this. Now, so Yoni... Yoni now wants to take possession of the field because Gabe hasn't paid. And Ari comes and says, you know, I'm the bar mitzvah. I'll pay you back the loan. And instead, I will take the field. That's possibility one. Possibility two is that in the interim, Gabe sells the field to someone else, let's say to Ari, who happens to be bar mitzvah or not. And Yoni says, one second. He says, if you're going to sell the field, conditioned on you not paying back the loan, I want to buy the field. Then we'll just cancel out the loan. So, right, those are two possibilities of who wants to make the, well, who would like to claim the field? Right, you only talk about some type of conflict with either Bar Mitzvah when a sale has taken place and when somebody doesn't like that sale. So either it's Ari doesn't like the sale to Yoni when Gabe doesn't pay back the loan because Ari is a bar mitzvah, or Gabe goes ahead and sells the field to Ari, which at the minimum means that Ari has the ability, Yoni has to pay back, he may take that money and pay Yoni back with it. He may take that money and blow it in Vegas and do what he wants, but at some point he's going to have to pay money back. I mean, Masala Yoni. If he doesn't, of course, that's a given that Yoni has prior rights to Ari to seize that field because he was given it. It's still in Yoni's possession as a mashkon. It's not his, but it's the possession as a mashkon. So the question will be, which of those two are we talking about here? One or both? There's another possibility that gets thrown in, and this opinion exists in Rishonim, which is Gabe borrows money from Yoni because and gives Yoni the field as a mashkon. Ari hears about this and says, wait, I'll lend him the money. Give him the money back, Gabe. I'll lend him the money, and I'll take the field as a mashkon because I'm a bar mitzvah, and if he doesn't pay back, I'll take it. Which is, in effect, a way of assuming, as the Gemara is going to say, that there's no din of the bar mitzvah here. So what it would be telling us is that Ari cannot force that arrangement. He can't force that arrangement. Or, if you say that the Gemara is not talking about it, could, in fact, Ari force that arrangement? You have to allow that possibility to say, listen, you know, you're lending him the money. What this means in the future, potentially, is that this is going to, he's going to default, Gabe is going to default, and somebody's going to get the field, and I'm a matron. I want the field. So firstly, what does the Gemara say? I guess I have to choose somebody to read, don't I? That would be good. Rami?
Smash mashkanta late by mishum dinu de bar mitzra. Damar of Ashim, amru le sabi de bat mechasya. My mashkanta dishkun agave. My nakimina the dinu de bar mitzra.
Okay, so the Gemara happens to be. The Gemara is a kind of a funny way it's formulated from a literary construction. What's bothering me is the last six words, Mainaf Gamin al Dina de Bar Mitzvah. You know what my response to that is? Of course. Why? In other words, the Gemara just quoted for this reason. Just look at the way it's quoted. Mashkanta lesbim shun din de bar mitzvah. De amar avashi, amar lo sabi de masa mechasya, my mashkanta de shkun agabe, my nafkabino de din de bar mitzvah. So, do you understand what's bothering me about the way it's presented? Okay?
Could be that was all part of Avashi's statement.
Agreed. So, I agree, that's the first step in realizing what's going on. So now, why does the Gemara, and you could say the Gemara quoted the whole thing, and that's actually what it did. But how should you have presented like this? How could the Gemara is redundant, repetitive? Ari? Correct. It could have started Amar Rav Ashi. Amar li sabri the mechasya mechasya, my mashkan, ta deshkun agadei, my nafkamino, din de bar mitzvah. So what's the answer?
Because if it's Amar Rav Ashi, then it sounds like maybe it's
No, that would be Rav Ashi Amar. Okay, why is it presented this way? I think the answer is simple. Rami?
All the other cases.
Correct. In other words, what you have here is the Gemara is a later, obviously it's post-Rav Ashi, that's not a surprise. You have a construction here of, you know, da-da-da-da, less by din ha-metzah, da-da-da-da, less by din ha-metzah, etc., etc. So the Gemara now has, they know this tradition of Rav Ashi, that it's called, they explained that the reason why Mashkon is called a Mashkon is the Shun Agadei, and the Nafkamina Rav Ashi said, when he taught this, was Dina Debar Metzer, so now the Gemara just says, Mashkanta Lesa Mashin Debar Metzer, and they quote the whole thing. So yes, it is redundant or repetitive, but that's only because it's the way the Sugya is constructed, right?
Does that mean that the Nafkamina was said by Rav Ashi, or just that, like, we don't think that Rav Ashi was like writing his dissertation on
We have no way of knowing that. In other words, I don't think we have this Meimor Rav Ashi anywhere else. So clearly in this Gemara, it's a unit that's being incorporated. So it could be that if you dig down to the original unit, is it Rav Ashi's statement and then a Peirush on it? It's possible. There's no way to prove it. This point is not, firstly, when you learn Gemara, you should pay attention to what the text says and wonder why it's constructed that way. But this also highlights a particular sheet of Rishonim that both Rashi and the Rif adopt a certain approach to a few lines down from now, when it says Shchene Ha'ir Ushchene Sada Shchene Ha'ir Kodmin dot dot dot. You have a few examples of that. So both, in contrast to Tosas, both Rashi and the Rif say this has nothing to do with Dina de Bar Mitzvah. This is not referring to Dina de Bar Mitzvah. Why? Because it's supposed to fit in the format of the Gemara. So either those cases should have been incorporated into the statement of Isha liyasme l'shutzvei u'l'shchein esadeh l'shchein ha'ir, etc., l'asbo dina de bar mitzvah. Or, after giving the first statement, you would have said, you would have not used the term kodmin, but you would have turned lesbe mishum dina de bar mitzvah. Or isbe mishum dina de bar mitzvah. Because that's the format of the sugya. Now, you can ask a question, which the Mishonah don't address, and I don't think we can really answer, and we can guess, why did they infuse this here? In other words, it kind of breaks up the flow. But the fact that it's not formulated the way the rest of the sugya is what prompts Rashi and the Rif to say, oh, that's not Dina de Bar Mitzvah. That's just a separate thing. It's like an Eitz HaTovah. Like, you know, it's obviously relevant in some sense of doing good, of what's the best good, but it's not Dina de Bar Mitzvah. So, okay. So, yes, Gabe.
That's
the lashon
of Mashach.
Who are you reading? I just want to see what the correction is. Yes, yeah, so shechuna means, can anybody translate the word shechuna? It's a good English word for it. Ensconced. It's a passive participle. It's like suva, written. So shechuna gabe, it's all ensconced by him. That's what a mashkon is. In other words, so what does that mean then? So now flesh that out, Gabe. What is the understanding? Why is there no din of, why is there no din of the bar mitzvah by a mashkon? The way Rashi, for the moment, the way Rashi explains that if the owner sells it to the one who's holding it, the one who's lemisha mimushkenes lo, so if you sell it to Yoni, why is there no din of the bar mitzvah? Well, let's say he's at least a matzron as much. He's a matzron. He's a matzron. If you say, you know why I want to avoid that formulation, he's more of a matzron. Because let's say you sold it to Ari, who's a matzron on the field. If you say he's more of a matzron, it means he could seize it from Ari. Right. So we have to allow for both possibilities. And I think both exist in the Rishonim. Okay, So, the way Rashi understands, I think everybody understands, that even though the Baal Hamashkon does not actually own the land, nonetheless, he is considered a matzron. It's close. It's not the same thing as shutfin in the land they own jointly. Now, it is kind of interesting, because I'm pretty sure that a socher is not, you don't know, din of the bar mitzvah. It must be stated explicitly. And that someone who's renting the land can't claim priority on a neighboring field in purchase because he doesn't actually own the land. I think that's a, if it's not stated explicitly, I'm sure it's probably stated in the Torah. I'm sure he quotes it. But it's a davar pashut. So it's kind of interesting that a mashkon is such. What's the difference, obviously, between a mashkon and tzchiras? Rami? So that makes it better or worse?
I mean, you'd think that, like if we're closer to a shoal, for example, that would make him closer to an owner.
Okay, but it's not the case. In fact, I just realize now. I realize I can sort of prove. How do I know that a socher doesn't have the end of the bar mitzvah?
He's either like a shoal or a gemara.
No. How do I know from our gemara? What's that? Mari Da'ara, and yes, correct. And the death Mari Da'ara and Mari Dikle. In both those cases, the way that we show them seem to understand it, and I don't think there's a better way of understanding it, is that by the trees, it's a case, and the Rif says this explicitly. And Rashi says it a little bit, he says it by trees, and other we show them, I think the Rashba spells it out by bias and karka. In me, the bias and karka case is strange. Because the bias in karka, normally when you own the house, you own the house. It's not that you own the rights to keep your house on, it's not like it's a mobile home, that you have the rights to keep it on that field only until a certain time. But that's how the Rashba says. I mean, and that would seem to follow from the Dekel case, where the Rif says by the Dekel case, it's only a situation where you don't own karka. So that's a case, Rami, that's really not different than, that's like Schiris, whatever the arrangement is, and therefore there's no din of the bar mitzvah there. No din of the bar mitzvah for the Baal Habayis or the Baal Hadekel. But the difference then between the mashkon, so why then is the mashkon? Why, and it's why by a mashkon, at least there's there's no din of the bar mitzvah, meaning Yoni's having the mashkon can, and let me flip this around. I'm pretty sure we would say, this is not explicit in the Gemara, yes it is explicit in the Gemara in that same case, that a No, it isn't. Let's say I'm renting the field. Wait, is there a reverse case? Hold on. Keep going back and forth on this. The this is also obvious, but I guess if Yoni bought the field, if somebody buys a field next to the one they're renting, somebody else can be dochanim. We don't say that they're enough. We don't say that they are enough of a matzron because they're a sachir in it. I'm pretty sure we don't say that. That therefore they could be docha a real matzron if they beat them to it. So by the mashkel, no, we are clearly saying that. Right? We are clearly saying that Yoni, the mamushkan, is able to be docha Ari, who's a matzron, if Yoni bought it first. That's for sure. Right? That's for sure. Certainly the way Rashi reads, I think everybody probably agrees that thing is subsumed within this din of mashkel. So what's the difference between Yoni and the Sachir? I think the Sachir is going to lose. If someone were if Elimelech is renting the field next to Ari, and then he decides to buy it, Ari can be dochem, even though Elimelech was renting the field. So what's the difference? After all, Rami said that there's more usage for the Sachir than there is for the Mamashkin. So you think the answer is the Sachir, you know it's going back at the end of its term. The Mashkin, there's a real possibility that in fact it's going to be Nechlat to Yoni, and therefore he already has a greater potential permanent shaychus to the land than does the Sachir. Fine?
Doesn't that sort of cause a little bit of difficulty in the there's no difference, you just go if you had a difference to the land. Like, yeah, there is some difference, even if it's temporary.
Say that again?
The Sachir wants to get the neighboring land because it's not promised.
Right.
The neighbor's land is more beneficial to the Sachir for whatever thing he has in Skivos.
But I think that you think you just answered your question. If I'm right, I'm pretty sure I'm right. But if I'm right, then you answer the question. It's for whatever time of the Skivos, because it's.
But then it's not all the same to me. Then it makes a difference. So don't tell me you actually match it.
No, but it's not. But it's not enough. You mean if you preempt? So what I'm going to tell you is the following. By every case of being at the Bar Mitzvah, there is some benefit to the Lokeach. For starters, that right now there's already a Tircha benefit of not having to be Tareach again. So I think that it's a question of evaluating how much that benefit is versus the benefit to the real matzah. That's what I would say. That's what I would say. Okay. Yes?
Would that also solve the Messiah and Mosque and Mea problem?
Which case? Where he buys it for 100? Well, what do you mean? Didn't he? I thought the question just depended upon whether or not, you know.
In the case where he would have given anyone the discount, and essentially he's losing $100 in lost potential, is that within the range of acceptable terrifying?
That's, well, is that what, or is your, I thought you say, would you say that lost revach? Yeah, that's what you mean. In other words, are you asking that, does lost revach count? Is lost? No, it's not considered hefsed because it's lost revach. That's an interesting perspective. I find it hard. I'm still stuck on that. And I think I said in that case probably it's a case where you can he'll get another field for a bargain somewhere. That seems too much. That seems like a bridge too far to cross. Okay. Now, there is a sheet that's quoted by, I think, the Ramban. So I alluded to this before in our discussion, that someone might have a claim. And in fact, that person might say that if Yoni is lending the money to Gabe, that someone can come along and say, Ari comes along and says, no, I'll lend him the money and I'll take the mashkim because it's next to my field. So if it's ultimately Nechlat, I will benefit from that. So the Ramban says it's wrong. He says such a sheet is wrong because Dina de Bar Metzra does not apply to the Mocher. It only applies to the Lokeach. It only applies to the Lokeach. And therefore, when Gabe is borrowing the money from Yoni and giving him a mashkon, he's in effect selling the land. Gabe is the Mocher. And Gabe has every right to say, I prefer dealing with Yoni than dealing with Ari, because Yoni's an easier guy to deal with than Ari. If that's, and if it weren't the case, then, you know, he'd have no reason not to borrow the money from Ari. And we will, so, and our response is here, is that Dina de Bar Metzra does not apply to the Mocher, does not apply at the expense of the Mocher. And if the Mocher says, I have this consideration, then in fact, he's allowed to lend the money to whomever, borrow the money from whoever he wants to borrow the money. Okay. Well, just think about what's going on here. He's giving you money, you're giving him a field. It's not obviously a regular case of a mocher and lokeach, because your hope is that you give the money back and he gives you the field back or doesn't keep the field. But the dimyo, if you're going to try to apply Dina de Bar Metzra and say that Ari should have the right to lend you the money and therefore he will get first dibs on the field because he's already a Bar Metzra, so that would be thinking in terms of mocher and lokeach, because that's what you'd be doing. Ultimately, if you borrow money against the field and you don't pay back and the field is taken as payment, you've sold the field. That's what you've done. Okay, fine. So that's as far as mashkon is concerned. Next, Rami. Okay. Now, firstly, you know why these phrases are chosen. All this means is that I want to sell one piece of property and buy another. Right? So so why are these cases chosen? Because this is actually a din. It's a din in Eretz Yisrael by Sados, Yistei Achuza. That if you, when you sell a field, which is not a good thing, I know it's coming back in the over year, but when you sell a field, so there's a mitzvah of Geula. And there are rules about Geula, about redemption. Like when you sell somebody a field in Eretz Yisrael, there's an Anshei Yovel Noah, you have the right to buy the field back. But if it is a planting field, you have to wait at least 2 years or two growing seasons, whatever is longer. One of the things you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to sell another Shtei Achuza in order to redeem this Shtei Achuza. You can't be Mocher Berachok Ligol Bekarav, you can't be Mocher Bera Ligol Beyafeh. I'm pretty sure those being explicit, they're probably in Kiddushin in the first paragraph. So that's why they choose these examples. In other words, this is the kind of thing a person would do. Now, it's not a problem. This man has an Eretz Yisrael outside of Eretz Yisrael. Oh, I was going to just note before, this theme of the Bar Metzvah, the question of Tzchiras, is very important. Halach Lamaisi, you have to figure it out. I'm not sure of a Feirish Bethedin. You know why it's really important? In Eretz Yisrael today, you know why it's so important? Because large parts of Eretz Yisrael are not owned by the owners. It's a 99-year rental. Not all areas. The Yesh Chilukim. And what's really going to happen in the end, I don't know. But there's something with the I don't know which, it's not the JNF, I forget, but like all the land, not all the land, large parts of Eretz Yisrael belong to whatever agency, and you lease it for 99 years. What's that? Maybe it's the Jewish agency, yeah. So if that is really, you could question whether that's really to be treated as schiras. But if that were to be treated as schiras, now this would really matter. Does the din of Dina de Bar Metzah apply in Eretz Yisrael today? Right, because if you're not the owner, so then, you know, the svara, by svara, it should apply to a rental of those terms. And you might argue that the 99-year rental is mostly a legal fiction, although we don't know what will happen after the end of the 99 years. So, should make sure if you buy land in Eretz Yisrael, you better find out what the deal is. Okay, so anyway, So I'm sorry. So coming back to this, limkor berachov ligol bekarov, berava ligol beyotha. So why is there no din of the bar mitzvah here? Does someone want to explain? In two words, and then you have to explain why. The two words are pseida de mocher. Why is it a pseida de mocher? In other words, if I need to get that cash quickly, and because I have an opportunity to redeem, to buy a field that's closer to me, or to buy a better field. So in a case where I'm doing it for those reasons, if somebody can, and let's say, you have to assume almost that it's known that I'm buying for this reason. Well, I guess you don't even have to say it. I sell it for this reason, and somebody else wants to come and bump the buyer, which is going to hold things up. So I'm not entitled to not be held up here in time, because I've got to purchase out of the field. It might be passing. It might be passing opportunity. So this is the case of Pseid de Mocha. Okay.
Why are they going to call
it
useful?
That bothers me. That really does bother me. But the assumption is the following. I think the assumption is the following. And that's why I started to say before, I think you do have to say that, which is I explicitly sell it with this purpose in mind. And therefore, when a buyer comes to buy it, you know, I put up a sign looking to raise cash quickly of another real estate opportunity. A buyer comes and knows that there's no din of the bar mitzvah, he's more likely to come and buy it. If there's a din of the bar mitzvah, he may come and buy it, but first he's going to say, I want to make inquiries before I pay for a contract, before I do all these things, let's check it out. So when you announce something as a fire sale, I'll call it that, it's not a fire sale, but so then everybody understands that the din of bar mitzvah doesn't apply, and that will be attractive, that will allow me to raise the cash more quickly. But you're correct. Once you've sold the field, so they can fight out who's going to keep the field and who's going to then pony up more cash, but you're correct. So I think you have to say that when you're starting to sell it, you make that clear, and then it's easier to get buyers. Okay. Fine. So moving on. Okay. So firstly, what is the kraga?
Taxes.
And specifically, the head tax, the gugolta. So you have the head tax, you have mizone of either the almana or the daughters who are being nizone from the estate. I'm going to explain the way Rashi does, and I think that most Rishonim do not lakosis. This is talking, well, I'm sorry, I'll get to the next step. So, for kura. When someone has to be buried and you have to sell nechasim to pay for a burial. So this, once again, is a rush job to an extent. And therefore, we do not apply din of bar mitzvah because otherwise it's going to take you longer to have the sale go through. And the raya they bring to that, these things are considered nachutz, are considered particularly pressing, is that when you sell nechse yesomim, when you're forced to sell nechasim of the yesomim to pay for various things that even the yesomim have to pay, I mean, have to be taken out of the estate. It's not the yesomim's debt. It comes from the estate that they receive from their father. If a man dies and doesn't leave any money and his son becomes, but his daughter's to be supported and a wife to be supported and his son is a successful investment banker, so he's not obligated to support there's no technical obligation of supporting his father's almana or supporting his father's daughters, his sisters, because the ksuba, which guarantees mazon to the almana and mazonos to the daughters up until a certain age, is only from the estate of the father. But if he earns his own money, so there's no chiyuv upon, you never inherit a parent's debts. You only inherit assets, but if there are debts outstanding against those assets, the debts cancel those assets. But outside of that, there's no such thing in halacha as yarshining someone's debts. That doesn't work. That doesn't happen, I should say. So in this case, what's the purpose of selling without hachrasa, without a public announcement? What's that?
Speed.
Right? You can sell faster. Now, the concern is, maybe you don't get as much money. Because if you held a public auction, you'd have the guy, you know, running the auction, and you'd get more money. Okay. Fine. Next. Okay. So, to a woman, to Yisomim, and to Shutfei, we have to talk about this. There is no Dina de Bar Mitzvah. The Shutfei is the, well, the Yasme is the Yasom in this discussion of Yisomim. It doesn't get much attention. It's understood that the Yisomim, probably Yisomim Kitanim, can't purchase land so easily. They're not savvy. They're not, they don't get around. They're young. So Yisomim, if a Yasom buys a piece of land, there is no Dina de Bar Mitzvah. In Isha, the logic is the same, but as we discussed yesterday, there are different opinions in Rishonim here. There is a tradition in probably the Gaonim, or I should say in the Rimi Gasha's time, in one of his tshuvos, he quotes someone who says that this Isha is a blanket statement. The Gemara does not qualify it at all. It means any time a woman purchases land, there is no Dina de Bar Mitzvah on it, period. And others say no, that it really depends upon the circumstances. If she has a husband, and the husband, maybe it's possible, doesn't apply at all to an Eishes Ish, because her husband will go get land. And then the other question is, what if the husband and the wife engage in a conspiracy, a konunya? He buys the land, but he puts it in her possession. So this issue was dealt with by the Rimi Gash. I believe the Rif has also a tshuva on this. By Batim, note, I think that's where the Rif is. The Rif tshuva? I don't remember if it's about putting in his wife's name. Maybe not. There's a different tshuva. And the Rimi Gash thinks that it's ridiculous. Of course, if they engage in a harama, you undo it. It's not a blanket statement, even if it's in the name of the Isha. It doesn't matter. You certainly undo it. Whereas others said no. There was a sheet. I don't recognize who the name is, but it's in the tshuva. It's quoted in the sheet that Mikubet says that says that no, that there's no such that Isha, the Gemara never qualifies it. It applies to a Pnuya, Amana, Nesua. Doesn't matter. Harama is irrelevant. And the Rimi Gash thinks that's wrong. He thinks that Harama is a governing principle because it's all about Pasisaya Sharvatov. Okay. Fine. You can ask the question. Well, yeah. All right. Go ahead.
Okay.
So what is Shchene Ayir?
Neighbors that you have that who live next to where you live in the city.
And Shchene has Shchene Sada?
People who just happen to have fields that are adjacent to yours.
Wouldn't that be Dina de Bar Mitzvah? Correct. In other words, in the Sada, I have no markers today. Okay. I have a field here. Polster has a field here. I'm selling the field here. Okay. So in other words, it's not a bar mitzvah to the field that I'm selling, but he is my neighbor. And let's assume there's no bar mitzvah coming here. So Nisim lives next door to my house. Josh has a field that's next to one of my sados, let's say the other side. So, who should I give priority to? So what's the question? The answer is I can do whatever I want. And here I think, if you assume there's no Din of the Bar Mitzvah being discussed here, and probably even if you do assume that they're both Bar Mitzvahs and you're deciding who you should give to first, it's not Ma'akeh. I mean, if this is purely optional, Vasisei Yashar Vato. Once neither's a Matzron or both are a Matzron, so really, I could, since they're not, they don't have the same kind of, in other words, if they're both Matsranim, what it would mean is they both have a field adjoining, well, it's kind of hard to work out what Shchene Asada means, but even the Shchene Ha'ir have to have a, presumably, a field next to mine. So I don't know how we'd even make that work. Tosis does say something. I mean, I guess, right. They're both. So, explain it like Rashi. It simply means, what's the more appropriate kedimah? We have all sorts of kedimahs in halacha, where I have obligations tend to be, what do we call this? Concentric circles, right? In Hilchos Tzedakah, we have concentric circles. So first me, and then my parents, and then my relatives, and you know whoever's considered closer, and then my neighbors, and then my city folk, and then my country folk, and then Eretz Yisrael comes before another country by default. So you have concentric circles. So we always have these. You know, how do you decide? I once had a situation where I was invited to be Masada Kiddushin. I think it was not Kiddushin, at two different weddings that were at the same time. So I asked Bershechter for his advice. What did he think I should do? And he said something unbelievable to me. He said, when he gets two invitations to a wedding that conflict, two Talmidim, he tries to figure out who has more chevra. And whoever has more chevra, he goes to the other wedding. Because he figures the person with more chevra, has more chevra doing something after him, so his presence will make a bigger impact at the other one. Pretty unbelievable. In a good way, obviously. Okay. So anyway, so here the Gemara wants to know. Shchein ha'ir, shchein ha'sada, shchein ha'ir kodman. At the end of the day, the people who are closer to you, not because they have real estate next to yours, but because they live next to you. Shachein v'talmud chacham. Okay. So these are various kinds of kedimas. Rashi, it's interesting to note, says that this is not Dina de Bar Metzra. Because it wouldn't make sense that a Talmud Chacham would take priority, which is interesting. And he uses an expression. I don't know if any of you picked up on what it was. He said, Atu, because he's a Talmud Chacham, Mishalach Glima de Inche. You know what that means? No. Fine, you know? Strip the clothing off of them. There is a Gemara. It's stunning that the editors of the Bavli left it in, meaning they put it in. They chose to put it in, which is really striking. And it's obviously an important point that maybe a lot of Rabbanim don't want to hear. At one point, Rava accuses Rav Papa and Huni Berv Yeshua, theoretically could have been his Talmidim, in some particular case, I think it had to Nichse Hager, he basically accuses them paskin the halacha for their own benefit, and he describes them as kaki chivari mishalche glimit inshi, white geese. I think Rashi says that they have their beards, white beards, mishalche glimit inshi, stripping off the clothing off of people. That was not a kind thing to say about them. That's quite a harsh accusation, and it's in the Gemara, and it's about, I believe, Rapapa and Hunibar Yeshua. It's not about fly by night smichas, if you want to call it that. So really, but that's the expression, Mashalchei Glimit Inchi. In fact, I always wondered, Vayishalachu Es Kesonas HaPasim. It would be out of order, but some say, you know what it means, Vayishalachu Es Kesonas HaPasim. So the pshat probably is they sent it. But some have suggested, Vayishalachu Es Kesonas HaPasim. Do you know what the other interpretation suggested is? They tore it with a sword, because shelach in Ezra Nehemiah is a word that's used for a sword. And then, I always wonder whether there's a little bit of a pun there, because earlier it says, Vayashitu es Yosef es kutanto, and the Targum Rami of Vayashitu is Ve'ashlachu. It means to strip off, to remove the, you know, to be poshet, you know, out of it. It could be, you know, probably the Hishit es Ha'olah is also translated with, I'm guessing, maybe? Maybe not. But anyway, but Vayashitos Yosef is Kutanto, I believe, is Ashlachu. Okay, so Rashi says this can't be Din of the Bar Metzra. This is just, you know, preference. Now, the Gemara asks an interesting question. Yibailu. Yeah, this is an important statement that the Gemara makes. Contrary to the popular expression, blood is not thicker than water. You know, if you heard that expression, but. Okay. I don't know why the water part. I'm not sure how that means the friend as opposed to blood is your relative. But here the Pasuk initially tells us that blood is not thicker than water. Again, all other things equal, hakarov karov kodem, but nonetheless. Okay, go ahead. Okay, so this is a situation. So this is really interesting, and this is what serves as the basis for the, I think, the Gaonic position that there really is a time factor and a time limit on Dina de Bar Metzra. If Ari wants to buy that field from Gabe, it can't be, okay, I want to buy that field, but I first have to go sell stuff in order to raise the cash. Doesn't work that way. Essentially, for the mocher, it has to be ready to go. It has to be ready to go. And therefore, if Ari is going to delay the payment, then there's no dina de bar metzer because it comes, it does say to the mocher. There's a very interesting case that I think the Ramban cites. It's quoted in the Mukhe Yosef. I don't remember if I saw it in the Ramban originally. Supposing, get this, let's go to a regular sale. No more mashkon. Okay. No more mashkon. Or Gabe, you're selling a field to Yoni. Now, let's say you're going to extend credit to Yoni. Yoni, you have 60 days to pay me the $100 for the field. And Ari says, okay, I want to buy the field. So the Ramban says that if Ari wants the same terms, then he loses. Why? Because you can say it's easier for me to deal with Yoni than with Ari. He's an easier person to get along with. The only way that Ari can get the field there is to put the cash down right now. Then there's no time. So here, along the same lines, one person is paying by check, one person is paying by cash. Gabe, you can have a preference whether you prefer to be paid by check or by cash, and you can have a preference for either one. Either is legitimate. So you could have a situation, Yoni's paying you by check, and Ari's paying you by cash, and you say, I prefer a check. Or, vice versa, you could say, I prefer that, and that will override the Bar Metzra. What are these things actually? Zuzei Tavei, Rashi says that these are shkalim that are fuller. What does that mean? So today, as we discussed in yesterday's share, our coins aren't worth very much. Although a penny, even now a penny is probably they reduced it from copper to zinc, I think, in 1982. That's when they switched, because the copper was very expensive. So pennies are mostly zinc. But now that too is worth more than a penny. So why we continue to mint pennies seems beyond logic, but we do it anyway. So I'm sure there's some svara, or somebody's getting something. Okay. So once upon a time, though, coinage was tied to weight. In fact, as best as we can tell, and this doesn't contradict anything in Tanakh, and it only maybe has a conflict with something in one passage of Chazal, Pshat in Shkalim in the biblical period until the Second Temple period is they were weights, they were not coins. Because apparently minted coinage wasn't invented until like the 7th century in Lydia, I think. So even though we're used to thinking of Arba Meo Shekel Kesover LaSocher, Pshuto Shemikra, it's not a coin, it's a weight. And when I once heard a student of mine teaching this at Camp Stone, first I thought it was Avi Kursis. He didn't get it from me. And then I stopped, thought further. I did a little research. I realized, at least when you read Tanakh, there's nothing that indicates it one way or the other. Shekel HaKodesh is just the weight that Hekdesh used. But it could be, weight. It doesn't have to be a specific mefe. I know there are midrashim. Even some of those midrashim doesn't matter for minted coinage. Zayit knew, he showed him, again, it doesn't have to be a minted coin. Just God showed Moshe Rabbeinu the weight. How much is the Shekel HaKodesh? The only passage in Chazal that potentially, and there are ways to deal with it as well. Anyone know what the only problematic passage is? Correct. Tessa Sheish Shalav Tzura, the Drasha, the Machlokas Rabbi Dosan the Chachamim, whether you can use an Asimon. I know it means, I don't, does the word Asimon still used in modern Hebrew? You know what does it mean now?
Like usually you say Nafali Asimon means I understood something. It's like a phrase that comes from putting in the.
From the phone token. The phone token, which you no longer probably doesn't exist in Israel. And I think there are still payphones in New York City, in places. Haven't noticed one recently, but I think some of them still exist. But I expect in Israel, they're high-tech, they're no more. But the Asimon was basically a blank coin. It wasn't a coin that you would put in as a phone token to use. There is such a thing, it's called a payphone. I know that you guys, one day I might, if I'm still teaching, my students are going to look at me like I'm from outer space or Mars or something. Like, a payphone? A phone? Like that's fixed in the ground? Thus is us. But anyway, so that's what asimon means, a blank. That's what it means. So Rabbi Dosa says you can be poda master sheni on asimon. It's a mishnah in Adios, and the Chachamim say that it has to be the tzarta kesef biyat hakesef sheish for lof tzura. Okay, I'm not going to deal with it now. There are ways to deal with that particular question. So, but the bottom line is, even if it was minted, the weight was really what gave it its value. I shouldn't say that. The Gemara talks about a matbea being nifsal, and a matbea being nifsal means you had a minted coin, and now a new government and they declare this is not valid currency. The weight of the coin was still there. Theoretically, it could have been melted down for its value. So you have to both play a role. But in this case, clearly, the fuller the coin is, the better it is. Like people would shave coins, emperors would dilute coins. That would cause runaway inflation. So in this case, the shkolim being a fuller weight, and there's also the halacha talks about how much can in the fourth parak Mamatziah, how much can the coin be chaser and it's no longer valid. So a lot of makoros that relate to this. Bottom line is that you can have a coin that either is fuller, meaning it's full weight or better weight, or you could have a coin that is more yotze, that's more sort of acceptable, that more people take it. Right, that one has George Washington on it. This one has Robert E. Lee on it. And some places might be in a place where they like the Robert E. Lee coins better than George Washington. Whatever. So that's why there's no Dina de Bar Metro, because he can say, I prefer one over the other. Next. So this is the same thing. It's all about Seder the Mocher. If one person just sends, coins, and they're loose coins in an envelope, and one person says coins all bundled up, they're rolled up. So for one of them, he might be afraid to open the rolled coins because the other guy will say, well, I put $50 in that roll, and he's afraid that he's going to find less, and the person is going to accuse him of having stolen it. So whereas if they send loose coins, they can't really make that claim. Okay, so it's all, again, it's all, if it's a loss to the mocher in some way, if it's a detriment to the mocher, so then he's not allowed. Then there's no din of the bar mitzvah. Next. If I say I have to go and raise the money, not have to go home, and in my safe I have the money, I just need to get it. So then no deal. The mocher doesn't have to wait. Okay, but. Right, let's say that's the second case. In other words, do you believe that I have $10,000 of cash sitting in my home safe? Well, if I'm the kind of person who, with maybe not today, because only I don't say crazy person, but might not be the smartest idea. But once upon a time, when there was no bank to put your money in, is this person likely have the $10,000 or not? And if the person is Amid is the term for Ashir. I don't know its etymology. I imagine it's because it Amid means we like. I would say. We hold him in esteem. We estimate him. He's a person of estimable. I don't know if that's the word worth. So then we will wait for him to go bring it. That much we can do. Right?
Why is it that we don't say that you should just wait? I don't know. Half an hour, hour it takes him to go home and back. Right? Why is it that we're?
Why we do wait that? So the answer is because the author Lokech might walk away. So you tell me I'm going to go home and get the stuff. So if we look at you and say there's no way you have that, then the Lokech is almost certainly going to walk away. So if we think there's a reasonable probability you're not going to be able to come back then we'll say no, the guy doesn't have to wait. If we look at you and say, of course, you're Nelson Rockefeller VII, and of course you have these $10,000 sitting there. So then having the Lokech walk away is not going to be lost to the Mocher. Okay, go ahead. Okay, so that we discussed this a little bit earlier, which is, it has to be a case where the person who owns the land, the person who owns the bias doesn't have any rights in the land. More important, what it means is, he can only have his house there for the next, 12 years. So because he has a time limit when his house can be there, he's not considered having any permanent presence that generates a right to buy the land. Okay, but so what now? But the other way, but the mare ara is ma'akev on the mare bate. One second. Right. So here's where you get the discussion of Rabbeinu Tana, which is, and it essentially is a machlokas. It's fascinating looking at some of the comments that Rishonim make. Rabbeinu Tana claims that it's only in this case, when I have a balakarka and I want the bias. But if I have a bias and you're selling a house next to it, Rabbeinu Tam says there is no Dina de Bar Metzra. Why? Why is there no Dina de Bar Metzra? So the obvious answer, although it's going to still run a little bit afoul of this Gemara, maybe not. The obvious answer is because the whole purpose of Dina de Bar Metzra is that the costs of having two fields next to one another reduces the agricultural costs, the work costs. It's not relevant by Batim, right? That generally speaking, you know, even if it would be beneficial, when you have to pay a plumber, when you pay a plumber to come out, you pay him the same fee whether he fixes one toilet or two toilets, unless it takes him a really long time. You pay a certain initial fee for the certain amount of his time, but the odds are that it's not going to be that the toilet in one house breaks at the same time as the toilet in the other house breaks. So it's not like you gain such hana from having the 2 hours next to one another. So many Rishonim disagree with Rabbeinu Tam. But Rabbeinu Tam has, the Rashba, for example, says something fascinating. He says you could join the houses and make a bigger house. This sounds like, you know, modern day Tina. But then Rabbeinu Tam offers another really interesting comment, which I believe actually has moral implications, not halachic implications, for certain issues that I think are a big issue b'zman hazeh. You're not going to see the connection immediately. But is it appropriate to live in America and be living in America and staying there and buy an apartment in Israel and leave it empty? And I think the answer to the question is no. Because what that has done, it goes on regularly, is that if you're renting it out of Israel, it's one thing. But it has created, this has happened not only in Israel, it's happening with foreign money, Chinese money and Russian money, half of it probably dirty, in the United States, in Canada, has driven up real estate prices. You know, a significant part of the, I don't know how much, but in New York, in Toronto, in Vancouver, all these places, there's tons of foreign money coming in of homes sitting unoccupied. And what that does is it does a lot of damage to the people who live in the city. I was thought about that because there's a comment that Rabbeinu Tam, I believe, states. It's not in Tosis, I think it's in the quotation of the Rush. When the Rush cites him, which is that, listen, you have a house already. Right? What are you getting this other house for? This is not even as bad as the temporary situation. You're getting it to rent out. So you're trying to get the house next to you just so you can rent it out to someone else. He needs to buy a house. For you, it's an investment. It's one thing if you were living in it. The Rush buy. So it struck me. In other words, Rabbeinu Tam says, there's no deed of bar mitzvah there because it's not right. He has a greater claim than you do in that case. It struck me in this context because it really has made it hard for people living in Israel when you have all these Americans. So you see how much stuff is being built just for Americans. And again, if they're going to move there, that's one thing. So, okay, so you want to, and that's its own question. Of course, it's a good thing. I've already been criticized that I didn't push Aliyah enough. I'm not pushing it, but of course it's a good thing if they want to make Aliyah. But if you can leave it sitting empty, it means those things are being built, and it means that obviously means that things are not being built in ways that people who live in Israel can do them, and it dries up everything. And that's not right. It's not illegal, but I think it's not moral. Okay. So anyway, so this really, I think most Rishonim disagree with Rabbeinu Tam, even if his logic is reasonable. I think the Rif assumes just in passing that the Dina Metzer applies by Batim. He has an interesting tshuva. So, okay. So continue.
Ara de Fazi Tigre de Faz, Mari de Ara Matsi Me'ake Amari Dikle, Mari Dikle will Matsi Me'ake Amari de Ara.
As long as the owner of the tree doesn't have a chelek in the karka, and that by the way, is more, I don't want to say it's a Bikurim discussion, but it is a Bikurim discussion, because if I buy trees on your land, the Mishnah assume, I think we assume if I buy two trees, unless we explicitly state it, I'm not assumed to buy karaka, and therefore I cannot bring Bikurim and read the parsha, because it's not Adama Shanasata Li, it's not mine. Once I buy three trees, the assumption is I now own the karaka between them and a little bit outside of them, and then I can be maybe the kore. So here, we're assuming he only has two trees. It means he doesn't own anything in the karaka. Next. Okay, so this is really interesting. One person is a matzran. He's buying the field to plant it. And the other person is buying the field because he wants to build a house on it. He's not a matzran. And the Gemara says, the person who buys the house has the right to buy the field. Why? The land. Why? Because we consider yishuv about them to be a greater good for society. Whatever, I don't know why that is, but I guess they had a housing shortage. And therefore, what is the purpose of Asisa Hayashar Vatov? And I think this really, Asisa Hayashar Vatov is maximizing the good in the world. And here I think this makes it very clear. This makes it very clear. Asisa Hayashar Vatov, in the context of the Amatzah, is maximizing the good in the world. So normally, all other things equal, a Matzran increases the good in the world more. But here, even though the other guy's not a Matzran, there is a competing consideration. Okay, once again, very consequentialist. Or consequentialist or utilitarian. Yes. Next. So whatever exactly these details mean, it means there's something that's breaking up the two fields. And in order for Dina de Marmetz to reply, it has to be that it's truly, the benefit is gained, that you can make the field as one for the purposes of working them. So the Gemara is saying that if there's a way, you know, if they're joined enough somehow, then that's considered one field, Dina de Marmetz replies, otherwise it doesn't. Now, it's kind of interesting here, because I wonder, so what if there's, it's hard to penetrate? So you go around. Now, does it mean that if the workers have to go around, it goes so far to go around, you have to go around all the other fields and go 12 miles, that it doesn't bring the economic benefit? Or does it simply mean that the way the Chachamim Institute, look, Dina de Marmetzra is a svara, but they decided it had to be two adjoining fields. It was a formal takana to some extent, in the same way that some Rishonim claim, Isha lesma mishum Dina de Marmetzra. I mean, that's not the position I think we would normally adopt. But the summary should say, it says Isha, period. It doesn't matter what the circumstances. So is this really, in this case, does everybody say that there's a formalistic din, that you have to be able to kind of, in one swoop, join the fields? That's what it sounds like. So if they're not joined, it's not considered adjoining fields anymore. And technically speaking, there's no din of the Bar Mitzvah. I mean, I think one, and to some extent, it's probably correct, in the following sense. There are probably 1,000 scenarios in the world where we could have things that are just like Dina de Bar Mitzvah, where doing one thing commercially versus doing another would yield more benefit and no difference to you. And nonetheless, there's no takana de Rabbanan there. So of course there's Vasisa Yashar Batov, but what makes Dina de Bar Mitzvah unique is that it's actionable. It's enforceable by a court. Whereas generally speaking, we'll assume most Vasisa Yashar Batov, if not all, even with the exceptions that Be'a the Ramah quotes in Mordechai about Lefim Mishur Sadin, but generally speaking, most Lefim Mishur Sadin is not enforceable. It's not actionable. It's just it's a moral obligation, but it's not a legally enforceable obligation. Dina de Bar Mitzvah is one of the manifestations of legally enforceable obligation, but it's limited to what the takana was. Everything that doesn't technically fall under the takana falls back to the moral default, as opposed to a legal one. And finally, what really brings us, in some ways, to this entire sugya is the last line. Go ahead. Okay, so there are two dinim here. I mean, it's one din, which is that all matzranim are created equal, but that means if one comes first, he gets it all. No one can be dochim. If they all come at the same time, then we divide it up fairly equally. And how do you divide it up? So you can see the various kinds of diagrams. But if you have one field and one field on each side, you can divide it into four triangles. You bisect the square. But again, fields rarely come that neatly. And that's how you divide it up. Why is this the entry point for us into the sugya? Ephraim? No. I mean, you can make that connection. Ravina and Ronia, that's when we first encountered Din Debar Metzra. And what was he telling Ravina in the Bar Mitzvah case? So one of the possibilities is that Ravina was a Bar Mitzvah on three sides and Ronia was on one side, and Ravina thought that it gave him priority. And Rava's response, according to Tosfos, one day in Tosfos, was that all Matzranim were created equal, and whoever gets there first gets it. Right? In other words, if there are four Matzranim and one gets there first, he gets all four Halakim. So if Ronia only has one field adjoining and Ravina's three fields adjoining, if Ronia got there first, he gets the entire field. Yoni, you have a question?
Yeah, where did you get these diagrams in Rashi?
Rashi, I believe, in many cases, Rashi had his own diagrams, but they probably existed in Rashi's manuscript. But sometimes I suspect they got lost over time. And so I don't know whether this actually faithfully reflects Rashi's original. I don't know. I'm sure we have manuscripts somewhere, but the question is how old are they and how well were the diagrams copied? Okay. I'm going to stop here, and some of you will probably want to go downstairs.